The Young Vic's extraordinary production of The Changeling, the 1622 play by Thomas Middleton and William Rowley, has returned to the main auditorium at the Young Vic. It had a sell-out successful run in the studio, the Maria, here last year. No, sorry, it was earlier this year. It's a changeling like no other, rude, sexy, blackly funny, and involving a surprisingly high quotient of custody puddings. All the main roles have been recast, notably Beatrice Joanna. Sinead Matthews has taken over from Jessica Raine, and De Flores, Zubin Vala, now sports the carbuncles instead of Daniel Cercara. But most of the creative team remains the same, with director Joe Hill Gibbons and dramaturg Zoe Svensson continuing to work together in the bigger space. Zoe Svensson already has a number of director-dramaturg credits to her name and is artistic director of Metis and associate artist with the Company of Angels. She's with me, Heather Neal, now at the Young Vic, to talk to Theatre Voice about this amazing production. Well, welcome to Theatre Voice, Zoe. First of all, I thought it might be an idea to talk about your role as a dramaturg, what exactly that means, and how it dovetails with the director role, because you're a director as well sometimes.
Yes, well, I suppose maybe it's easier to talk about dramaturgy and the idea of dramaturgy, which is the structure of the play in time and space. That's how I understand it. So the scenic structure, how many scenes, the characters, and the form that takes determines how we see and understand the characters on stage. In some ways, it's the invisible scaffolding of any production. But it's unusual in this country, in the UK, to have somebody whose role is explicitly designated dramaturg, who is thinking particularly about that type, that element of the production. I think any given dramaturg takes on a role that is very much related to the personalities of people involved. And Joe and I have been having conversations for a long time about the British theatre and about work that we like in other countries, and about making work that really fills the emotional and complicated psychology of plays that aren't written with a kind of tidy, what I'd call Stanislavskian logic. Most modern plays have a single location, even where they have poetic dimensions. Often you can trace a psychological journey on the part of the characters through the play, and that's often what holds the attention of the audience. However, when you come to plays written in the Renaissance, quite often that isn't how they're structured, and certainly The Changeling isn't structured in that way. For example, there's very little backstory on the part of the characters, so you can't bring all the same directing tools as you might bring to a piece of new writing in order to fulfil what the play seems to be inviting. And we felt very excited and challenged by The Changeling, because it is so radical, it's so extreme in its emotional, I'd say arc, but it's not really an arc, it's more like a series of explosions. And I suppose that's its dramaturgy. It's a kind of, if the dramaturgy of a lot of plays involves a kind of explication of a situation that gets more and more complicated, through which the characters are developed and discover things about themselves and each other, and eventually there's a resolution. In The Changeling, it's more like a situation is set up which the characters attempts to solve the problem just leads to more problems and more problems and more problems until it all just unravels in disaster. So all of our process, we had a very long and time-intensive process before beginning rehearsals the first time round, including a two-week workshop in which we set up a series of improvisations around the text in order to kind of try and find out what happened when you make this play run. And my background is in European theatre and in experimental interdisciplinary projects. So I suppose I bring quite a different world to the process of thinking about the play from Joe, and so that sort of I think it's partly about that particular connection between the two of us, but also a very strong interest on his part that chimes with mine in really trying to understand what the play is actually doing. And I know the play's been described variously as Tarantino-esque, or our production of it as, and or you know, radical or playful, which all of which I think it, to some degree is true. But it, what's interesting is actually all of that emerged out of us trying to absolutely understand what the play itself was doing.
Well, perhaps we should say a little bit about what the play is about in plot terms, at any rate, because there are two plots which look separate but really aren't, and are very clearly made to intertwine in your production. Yes. Do you want to give us a run through? Beatrice Joanna has her unwanted lover killed.
That's right, yes.
By De Flores, who then demands...
Well, demands her virginity. Her, yes. I mean, I think it's a sort of... It starts with the... this is what I mean about the sort of problem, solving the problem in a way that creates more problems, which is that Beatrice Joanna discovers, falls in love with someone for the first time 5 days after being betrothed to somebody else. And then...
This is Alcimero,
who... And then lights on the idea that the servant who's obsessed with her might be willing to kill her lover, as you say, on her
whom behalf. She finds disgusting at this point.
Completely disgusting. And thinks of him as someone that could do that murder because she finds him disgusting. Mm. And then discovers very belatedly after the murder that, of course, De Flores isn't interested in money in return for the murder, but wants her virginity. And then, having succumbed to him, or having had to give up her virginity to him in order not to be discovered, she has the problem that she's no longer a virgin for her wedding night, and so has to work out what to do about that. That's what I mean, problems creating more problems all the way through the play. So she gets her serving maid, Diophanta, to stand in for her on the wedding night in the so-called bed trick, where her serving maid substitutes for her. But the serving maid enjoys it so much that she doesn't reappear on the strike of midnight. In fact, she, still by 3 a.m., she still hasn't reappeared from this first wedding night with Alcimero, Beatrice Joanna's husband. And so De Flores sets the castle on fire and kills Diophanta in the process in order that Beatrice won't be discovered. And at that point, you could end the play and it would all be all right. She wouldn't have been found out. However, at the last sequence, which we call the unravelling, everything falls apart. And by the end of the play, De Flores and Beatrice are dead. Mm.
And there's the other plot in the madhouse.
And then there's the other plot. Yeah.
Where one Antonio, who belongs to the castle which where Beatrice Joanna lives, is madly in love with the beautiful young wife of an old madhouse keeper, and pretends to be mad. Now, this is one thing you have done, isn't it? You've conflated two characters here,
right.
A madman and a fool,
yes.
Into Antonio, just having Antonio.
Yes.
And so he goes pretending to be mad into the madhouse.
That's right, yes. And I mean, one of the things that we did early on was as we were trying to understand the play, we kept reorganising it and trying to work out where the madhouse scene should go so that it would be the strongest possible thematic correlations, because they're very strong in the text, but they're not necessarily related by plot. And often that's meant that productions have cut them out altogether. The other thing about them is that they're seen as the comic subplot. Mm. Whilst
these were written by Rowley.
That's right. Mm. But Rowley also wrote the beginning and the end of the play.
Yes, that's interesting, isn't it?
To be honest, I mostly think of them probably sitting in some pub somewhere, both small and well, maybe in some attic, but actually communicating a lot of the time, a bit like, you know, the way that Joe and I, and Jeff also, the associate director who's been strongly involved, talk all the time about the dramaturgy of the play and how it's going to work, and thinking about... I mean, we changed a good number of words, only very slightly, and we tried our best to keep within the rhythms. Although in Middleton, they're he messes around a lot more. Mm-hmm.
But some is verse and some prose.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Exactly. So one of the things we wanted to do is really point up these thematic parallels between this madhouse plot and the castle plot, which is what we came to call them. Mm-hmm. But also in the process of doing that and reorganising the chronology, we discovered that. Of course, it isn't the case of having a tragic kind of high culture main plot and a comic low culture subplot. That actually the castle plot is horribly funny at times, and the lines are clearly written to be funny. It wasn't just a case of overlaying it with humour. Right near the end, right just before the really horrific deaths that they have, the Flores is accused of having laid a blow upon Paracuo, and he replies, "Upon him, 'twas quite through him, sure." Yes. You know, which you can see on the page is intended to be a funny line. And the other thing about that then was that it really changed the significance of the madhouse plot, which is a very dark story, because effectively it's another story about a man or a social situation attempting to control the sexuality of women. And the assault on Isabella. So Antonio enters the madhouse in order to, in inverted commas, seduce Isabella, but actually it's a form of assault. And she's been locked up in our production, literally in a cage, by her jealous husband, because gallants such as Antonio come to the madhouse to watch the mad people, and he doesn't want them to see Isabella, and he has to leave the madhouse. So she is locked up by Lollio, but Lollio is a deeply threatening character in his own right, and says on many an occasion to Isabella that if she falls, if she accepts the advances of Antonio, then he'll have his fool's part with her. It was much more about. What we wanted to do was mirror these, create two very different worlds that would also clearly mirror one another. Again, because that's what's in the play. And so to deny the darkness of the madhouse and to deny the comedy of the castle plot seemed to us to be a shame and a kind of misreading of the play, even though it's the standard one.
That it has been misread for some time because people have not realised the irony of.
I think we work very much on a plot basis, often of actual logical relationships between different elements, and when they aren't there, then we're less likely to work through the thematic mirroring. The other thing about the madhouse plot is it's often been seen as a kind of indication of a kind of Freudian. I mean, we didn't intend an anti-Freudian reading, but in retrospect, it was sort of. I was giving a paper about changeling and madness and 16th, 17th century constructions of madness. And as I went through what we'd done, I realised in retrospect that what we'd created was an very anti-Freudian reading. And that's because the dramaturgy of the play is all about desire. It's about what people want, and they want it now. Mm. And it's amazing. Beatrice Jara decides to get de Flores to kill her lover, not her lover, her betrothed, Paracuo. And 40 lines later, she asks him. Mm. That's not long. And these are characters, they're not repressed, the desires aren't repressed, they're right there on
and
the surface.
And they don't think of consequences.
Exactly. Mm. And so this sort of system of thinking about the logic of cause and effect and the character development and so on doesn't necessarily help us with this play precisely for that reason, because they're absolutely focused on the moment. Mm. So one of the things that Joe and I did was reinvent the language of a Stanislavskian form of rehearsing. For two reasons. One was that was to do with this idea. Another was that we didn't want to move entirely away from the way that Joe always works and is very familiar to the actors, because the last thing you want to do is send an actor out into a performance without all the tools that they have to do that, because it's a vast responsibility. They carry the show. You know, we can have all the ideas we like, but we're not out there on stage. But on the other hand, we felt that this, what's usually described as an intention or an objective and an event, the points in the play where the characters change what they want, gave a sort of sense of a much more larger arc than is necessarily in the writing. The characters want things. So we talked about wants and we talked about pivots. So that the moment of change was a physical change. Mm. And we did exercises early on in rehearsal in which that's exactly what the actors were required to do, that every time a change occurred and what the characters wanted, they had to move physically. And it immediately orientated the whole thinking of the production towards something that was much more physical and much more immediate. So any given want, we weren't then tracing through how that want related to, a super objective or anything like that. It was much more, each character's thinking about how do I get from A to B? And as you say, they don't think about the consequences. And so we were devising a structure for rehearsing that enabled us to achieve that.
Now, Antonio is listed as the changeling. Is he the changeling, or he's not the only changeling, perhaps?
At the end of the play, Alsamiro asks or describes various different characters as having changed in some way, and then asks, is there anyone else who's changed? And Isabella says to her husband, Alibias, you haven't changed. You're a fool.
These are the madhouse people.
Yes, and they've been brought in by a kind of sleight of hand.
But Beatrice Joanna's name is a double. Is that significant? Is he kind of two people in one?
Yeah. Well, this is where I think sometimes the Freudian, sort of grist to the Freudian reading. But I think it's also the Alsamiro describes it once as having a black mask. And the...
Alsamiro is the man she wants to marry.
Sorry, yes. Yeah. Trying to think if I could recapture the whole quote there. But that she isn't what she seems. Mm. But of course, in herself, she is, in a sense. The play is about colliding ideas about what the world should be like characters' desires to achieve what they want. De Flores wants to be the gentleman that he was born at, but is now a servant, and he wants, with this extraordinary sexual inescapability, to have Beatrice Joanna. Beatrice Joanna wants to be in charge of her life. She wants to marry the man that she has chosen, and then the ways the characters then clash because they just don't see each other's perspective is quite extraordinary and quite wonderful. Mm-hmm. And so that was the other thing that we kind of worked on and decided was that we weren't going to create a kind of simple empirical location that was one world in one period and in one way. I mean, the play's not written like that because it supposedly takes place in Spain, but there you have a kind of carbon copy of London's Bedlam Hospital. Mm. So it already is mixing up. It's just taking what is useful in that moment to give create the identity of the relationship.
De Flores murders Piracuo, he cuts off his finger with which still has the ring attached, and of course it's quite a funny line. I couldn't get the ring without bringing the finger as well. Mm. I mean, presumably that's very much a kind of Jacobean extra. I mean, obviously it has sexy connotations as well. Mm. So that's part of what's going on already, but it's the kind of thing that a Jacobean audience would have loved, isn't it?
It's where, again, there are these parallels between the madhouse plot and the castle plot, in that there's a sort of riff between Alibias, the madhouse keeper, and Lollio, his sidekick, about Alibias says, I would keep my ring upon my own finger if I let it by, others will be thrusting into it. And of course, he's talking about Isabella.
Yeah.
So, but I think, absolutely, I think that's where this notion of it being all tragic or all comic is... Mm. Is a maybe a modern 20th century conception. Yeah.
Well, the treatment of mad people, of course, is simply embarrassing and difficult for modern people. But you don't have an antic dance as is in the original. I mean, you do, but not of mad people there to entertain the others. We have everybody in it.
Yes. Well, we thought that actually too. So Originally, the third madhouse scene comes later in the play, and we moved it to the positions it's in our production because we felt that the dance, what we did was we mashed together the dumb show wedding that's in the text and the rehearsal of the dance. So depending on how you look at it, it's either the mad people dressed up as in wedding gear doing a kind of mimicry of a wedding. I think in the spirit as you find in the dumb show in Hamlet or in other plays of you know, in Hamlet's play within a play, they do a silent version before they do the real thing. So so we were sort of drawing on that on that idea, that tradition. But at the same time, they are also in the costumes that they will be in the castle plot for the rest of the play. But there's a sense of the vortex where all of the craziness of the madhouse somehow gets wrapped into the main plot, and which then just goes wild because the rest of the play is kind of like...
I think you should say something about the music here, because this is tremendously important, isn't it, in the mood?
Yes, yeah. Well, interesting in previews and particularly in the studio version, because the Young Vic has a fantastic policy of opening the theatre to the widest possible range of people and ages. In previews, the majority of the audience were very young, by which I mean sort of 16, 17 years old, from the local area. And at the point in the where the madhouse comes out, we did a mashup of the Wedding March and Beyoncé's Single Ladies, which is the genius idea of Maxine Doyle, who's the choreographer. And when that came on, there was this sort of whooping, and it was like a wonderful sense of license. And I think, over the time of seeing the show, because we watch every night all through previews and then come back in at other times doing the run, both times, just the conversations that I've overheard afterwards, particularly among that age group, just absolutely like wonderful, but also brilliant for us, because it gave us the courage of our convictions, in the sense that we could see people who are coming to drama of this period possibly for the first time, or possibly seen some Shakespeare but in a very different context, suddenly going, oh, this is a play for me too, and this is a play about things I get. And that's really exciting, because actually it feels like we're fulfilling what the play is trying to do. And so that sort of playfulness around with reference to contemporary culture, and then also the thing we always enjoyed was that we worked for a long time on how to structure the sequence we call Wedding Night, in which Beatrice is trying to organise Diophanta into replacing her that night, and Vermandiro threatens Tommaso, who is the brother of the murdered Peracquo, and is also trying to find out from De Flores where Antonio has disappeared to, because they suspect him of the murder. I mean, there's lots of things going on. It all felt like their little conversation. It felt like maybe they were sort of backstage. So we in the space, we have a big banqueting table, and that then became the sort of post-dinner time, where everybody had gone off into the party room, which we called the party room, which was a soundproof box, which was literally soundproof, so that every time anyone opened the door to come in...
That's so funny.
Yeah. It was really fun. I'm glad you found it funny, because we really enjoyed it. It's one of those things you hope the audience are going to enjoy as much as you do. It meant that... So there's a sense in which the main party was happening somewhere else, and the characters were coming in and out to find each other or to do things that were secret or behind the scenes or around the back corridors. And Jasperino has overheard De Flores and Beatrice together and tells Alcimiro, who then makes Beatrice take a virginity test. So there's all sorts of mad things going on in that.
We must come back to the virginity test.
Yes, in that sequence. And so we were trying to work out how to do this in a way that that didn't feel bitty. So I think when you see it on the page, you think, oh God, we need to cut lots of this because it's all sort of, it just goes on and on and there's lots of things. But once we found this spatial form, which was, yeah, as you said, is at one level is a kind of joke because every time the door opens, the music comes out and you get this sense of this other party. But another level is really kind of structures the whole sequence in a way that makes each of those conversations interesting, because they're actually all really matter to the plot, but they don't necessarily logically relate to each other. They just relate to the overall trajectory. And the way that we devised it in the end then was to do a improvisation that we called a jam, where before we had gone through the whole thing and talked about the psychology of the characters, we got them to get a rough grasp of the overall structure of what happened, and then got them to play through and improvise what they said to each other, what was happening, and Joe would call out instructions about what happened next over a microphone, and they would just try out the whole thing, and you suddenly were getting really interesting work happening in interesting encounters. It was also a way of understanding all the things that were happening off stage, because a lot of things happen that we don't see through that as well. So it helped. The idea was to help the actors find the characters' journey through that sequence, but also to discover what was at stake. Because and so we had lots of parallel action going on. You have some people having sex over here while some other people were discussing something, and then someone would come on and say, "Well, I've seen them have sex," and then and then the next thing would happen, and then someone, So this was sort of. That's how we discovered this structure of how we used this party room. So in that sense, the music enabled us, was fundamental to the structuring of the production.
Well, the virginity test. I mean, Al Somero, it's a bit odd that he goes around with the virginity test in his cupboard, but perhaps he, just wanted to make sure. But it's a very strange test. And you have decided in this production that incontinently gape means actually being incontinent for a moment rather than gaping incontinently. So that's an unexpected moment. And it happens twice, of course, because two people have to go through it. And then there's sneezing and laughing. So it's a very strange test anyway.
Yes.
And it's very funny to have it twice.
Well, Jess Barino says that's a strange trick to know a maid by. Yeah. So it's commented on in the text itself. And the thing also that makes it, the thing about the incontinently gaping peeing, partly it's kind of funny and unexpected, but partly because it's done twice, then you have the fun of watching Beatrice Joanna have to fake wetting herself. Yeah. Whereas if it was just yawning, it wouldn't have the same, have the same energy to it. And I think absolutely in the spirit of the kind of viscerality of the writing. And one of the things that we, were concerned about at the beginning, although I think actually we in the end it didn't matter, was that it's an extremely rude play, and a good percentage of that isn't available to a modern audience.
No, that's right. The puns and the so on. Yeah, so you just it's not clear now.
Well, and we didn't want to have a kind of we didn't want to do the sort of production where it's sort of gestured at, like, oh, you audience won't get this pun because it's old fashioned language, so we're going to sort of do an obscene gesture and you're going to laugh politely. That wasn't on our agenda, although we did do an exercise early on where we got them to illustrate all of everything that was rude about it, which was so funny that some of it did stay in, because actually the overemphasis on it was sometimes also quite funny. We didn't want the actors to have to be somehow explaining gesturally or in their acting to the audience what was actually going on, because there was a fear that the audience wouldn't understand because of the language. So we did a lot of work to either through cutting or the substitution of the odd word, and through the work we did with the actors on the situation, to ensure that it was really, really clear. And that was a big, big drive in the whole thing. And I suppose my role in that, in terms of, obviously that was what Joe was doing in rehearsal, but I was watching and thinking about it and just taking us, having a more reflective response to that.
Well, there are some quite clearly cartoonish ideas. The usefulness of the puddings, for a start.
Yeah.
all sorts of blancmanges and custards and things, which perhaps you better say a bit more about. But also in the costumes, Isabella, you have doubling, of course, so Diophanta, when she turns into Isabella, has got a sort of Katie Price bosom and a different wig. And Lollio, who's also doubling, he has a very strange shape, an enormous bottom. In fact, Rowley is supposed to have played Lollio, isn't he? And he was supposed to have been really fat.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
Rowley
Pony. It's all authentic.
Yeah, it's all authentic, absolutely.
It's a historically accurate production.
But they obviously do look... I mean, that is one distinction between the madhouse and the castle, isn't it? You don't have anyone in the castle dressed quite like that.
No. I mean, I think our thinking about the madhouse was that it could get very bogged down in attempts to represent madness. And I did some research on madness in the 17th century, and it's really interesting because madness was very tightly bound up in senses of social identity. So if you didn't want to marry the person your family wanted you to marry, then and you really refused, then you were considered to be mad. Yeah. And madness was something that happened to you. You went mad. So love would drive you, could drive you mad, which is obviously what happens, actually, to all the main characters in the Changeling. And a fool was somebody who was mad from birth. Not mad, but displayed ways of doing
mental
things.
Mental impairment of some sort.
It was all to do with not conforming, really, to expectations. So there's some wonderful writing about someone smashing all their windows in their house, and glass was extraordinarily expensive. So the idea that you might smash your own property, obviously you were insane, because that isn't what you would do normally. And all the things about clothes and social identity were very strong. So this is where you get in Lear, the unaccommodated man and him stripping. If you ripped up your clothes or tried to strip off, then you must be mad, because clothes, much more strongly then than now, made your identity. I mean, it made gender as much as it did.
And they were very expensive if you were at all well off.
Exactly, yeah. So... which doesn't really answer your question, but was sort of the thinking behind all that. And so the madhouse, I think what we did was we tried to push or understand as far as we could what the characters' positions were in relation to each other, because it was so clear that the characters' positions weren't, and who they were and what they were doing wasn't about explicating a particular world. I was saying it wasn't about, you know, being true to Bedlam in the 17th century. When it was written, that wasn't about that. That was a situation in order to allow a position in which a jealous husband had a wife who was stuck. And so we did lots of improvisations where we tried to explore what would you do. Alibi says my wife is young. And he's clearly terrified that she's going to sleep with someone else. So what would your situation be if that was you in that situation? You're surrounded by men who are obscene in one way or the other, another. And then we think, well, does she want to... Why did she marry him? Maybe she wants to please him? She wants to look... So there's a sense in which we're sort of asking a series of questions that you might ask within a Stanislavskian process, but the play doesn't answer them. But what it does do is offer the possibility of certain kinds of acute situations. So we thought, if Isabella is doing her absolute best to be, a great wife in all ways she can think of, and yet she's, the irony is she is locked up and no one can see her, so then we go, well, she's driven a bit mad by that, so maybe in some way she's kind of on tranquilizer. So the whole thing, and then you've got the sort of echo of Russian brides, or this sort of that thing of breast implants or whatever that you make yourself, so it came out of a kind of, I suppose, quite a kind of complex field of thinking in a way, but it was also a kind of playfulness, something fun that was in the spirit of the writing, that isn't a kind of true to life.
Yeah. Well, there's quite a lot of playfulness, as we've said, with these puddings. Yeah. And the person who I came with said, they must have a lot of costumes. I said, I expect the cleaning's quite thorough, but because a lot of stuff gets thrown about. And the two on the bed, Diophanta, who's standing in for Beatrice Joanna on her wedding night and Alcimerio actually cover each other in, well, is it chocolate pudding? And
it's jelly, trifle, yeah. Chocolate sauce. Yeah.
And they don't hold back at all. Good for them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so no half measures. No, food is mentioned a lot in the text. They talk about appetite. De Flores says some women are odd feeders.
Yes.
That they commend slovenly dishes above dainty foods. And the so
another kind of desire, really.
Yes, another kind of desire. And the other thing, I think, so you know, we were trying this out through improvisation, but what we realised was that, of course, because food gets thrown at the end and becomes, so it's eaten, then it's used in sex, and then it becomes a tool for violence. And all of those elements are at times comic and at times not really very funny at all. So depending on your perspective, Alcimero and Diophanta smearing each other in jelly is hilarious. Or if you're Beatrice Joanna waiting for her to come out of the chamber, and we play it in the same space, so the actress can see them, but the character can't, or at least it's in her mind, you can imagine it's in her mind's eye. But she is being tortured by the thought that Diophanta is in there with her husband for hours and hours and hours. And
so she's done so much to get him, after all, hasn't she?
Exactly. And so the extreme of it. But at the same time, we weren't trying to use the jelly and so on as a metaphor for sex. Mm. Actually, it makes it a much more sexual scene than it would be if they were pretending to have more realistic stage sex.
And it goes on for a really long time.
It does, yeah. And and similarly with the violence. So there's a moment where Tommaso throws a trifle at De Flores, and then he goes to throw a trifle back at him, and then realizes he can't because he's got Tommaso's brother's death on his conscience. And so, on one level, it's a funny moment that sort of references, you know, panto or kind of British forms of comedy. It also represents, to some extent, Tommaso's complete ineffectualness. But at another level, it's real, and he throws it with all his might, and there isn't any holding back. So the act of violence in it, in terms of the physicality of the actor, is much greater than if he had sort of pretended to do a sort of stage fight. And similarly, at the end, after they've died, the two protagonists Beatrice Joanna and De Flores get pelted with food, which at one level is funny, potentially, but on another level, it's really quite horrible because, again, you can absolutely throw that food with all your might.
Yeah. Now, in fact, all the humour in it is also a bit disturbing. You know, it's off limits, and you're not quite sure what's going to happen next.
Yeah, it's a kind of flip. There's a flip side to everything. I think that's most embodied in the character of Antonio and his rendering of a mad person, because it's a crass kind of cliche of how somebody who is very thoughtless about the actual experiences of people with mental or physical disturbances, and so he comes, how they would really feel. He comes on in a wheelchair, and it's a very primary colour, slightly disturbing moment. When he then reveals who he really is, there's a sense of it, because he's an equally crass lover. Like his poetry is really bad. I mean, it's deliberately been written to be terrible. And his idea of what seduction is really awful, which is basically assault. Yeah. So there's a through line through that character's world, but also and then there's obviously a humour to that, but there's a very dark side to it as well. And it's very much on the line of bad taste, but that again is not really an imposition on the text so much as an attempt to really do what the text seems to be asking for.
Well, of course, famously, it's about the closeness of love and hate. This play, or the main plot, is, and. Is that a bit too Freudian? I mean, does she think enough about one thing or the other? Is lust the same as love to her?
With Beatrice, she says to De Flores, "I must love thee now."
because he helps her.
Mm. Of course, they're in something secret much more closely than they can be with anybody else ever again.
Yeah, and she says, I'm forced to love thee. And this forcing, I mean, I think everyone has to interpret it in their own way. Mm. The writing is not psychological in a way that you can clearly land quite what the relationship is. And I think the relationship is seen differently by the characters at different times. And for me, that's like life. So we avoided a reading in which we knew exactly how they felt, you know, about, in terms of the, you know, in terms of, some critics have called it seduction. I wouldn't really call what happens in front of your eyes in our production seduction. I'd call it not necessarily quite rape, but certainly much close to that. Mm. But at the same time, by the end of the play, he is the only person that can help her, and she's stuck. So there's a survivalist instinct, I think, that's very strong in the character that is emerging. But it's composed of a series of ingredients in which we see her in different situations, and a modern eye wants to make them add up to something neat. Mm. And I think the brilliance of the play, and I hope the success of the production, is that we don't do that, because real life is much, much more complicated. So it's not a sort of woman who thinks she's pure, but is her secreted, really loves the disgusting man, and she just secretly wants to have sex with him. Partly because I think that plays into some male, you know, into a slightly unpleasant idea that's to do with certain kinds of male fantasy. But I just, you know, don't really want to go there, to be honest. much more interested in what happens to someone when they find themselves in that situation.
Mm.
What do you do? Mm. I mean, what she does is try and survive.
Mm. Well, what we haven't talked about is the sense of being in that space when you're the audience, because we're looking through. We're either looking out of a sort of box, or we're looking through mesh. Mm. And so much happens in cupboards and cages. Mm. We're reminded all the time about prison, but also about kind of sport as well.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yes, I mean, the characters talk to the audience a lot.
Mm.
And one decision that we made was that we were going, again, this is something about language, that we describe that a lot of all of the what are normally called asides as talking to the audience.
Yeah.
Because it became very quickly clear that there was always an audience there. It wasn't a case of being in a scene and then kind of coming out of the scene and saying something and then going back into the scene. The audience is present all the time, and the audience in our production is present all the time. And one of the things we do is we very lightly light the audience for most of the show. So it's not necessarily completely obvious, but you're as an audience member, you're always part of what's happening, and the actors can then look someone in the eye and talk to them. They're not blinded by the lights, but also the fact that it's in the round means that wherever they look, they're confronted with people watching them. So there's always a sense of, I mean, we gave the audience different names at different points, like judge or friend or demon or troll, to kind of think through the different kinds of attitudes that the characters had at different points to who the audience might be when they're talking to them. And it's a wonderful way of opening up to my mind, there's not much in the way of subtext in the play, because it's all spoken out. The conversations with the audience are the subtext in that sense. And that's very rich, and that spatial configuration very cleverly allowed us to draw that out. I mean, Altz is, you know, a wonderful designer, and it was amazing to work with him actually on this, because especially from the point of view of dramaturgy, he's absolutely acutely thinks through everything about space. He's a designer of space, and that profoundly affects how the playing works.
Mm. Just one more question. You've moved this from quite a small space into a bigger one and changed some of the cast. So did that make any difference to your approach? I mean, I saw it in both spaces, and it's very much the same production. Mm. but of course spread out rather more now than it was. Did you rethink anything?
We rethought some of our process, and because I think we were still always trying to work out effectively the spatial dramaturgy, how to. So the space is a kind of multi-location space, but at the same time, it's not multi-location in the sense of one section of the stage is one thing and another section is another thing. Mm. It allows us to switch very quickly between different places, but also the play isn't written to be in necessarily in particular places at various points. Anyway, it's much more interested in relationship than it is in location or whatever. Sorry, I'm slightly lost where I was going with that. But the transition. So the transition So by the end of the first production, we had come to understand how that worked in the play. So we had all that at our disposal when we were coming to it second time round. So we already knew a lot of the spatial structure, and then when we didn't know or we didn't feel satisfied with the time before, we knew what we needed to work on. And I think that gave a kind of freedom actually to enable a greater concentration on the acting. Mm. And we did a lot of improvisation again, but rather than thinking of it as improvisation being kind of exercises and then rehearsing as being the thing we did towards the production, we were just rehearsing, which enabled us to hold on to a lot more of the rich material that came up in the improvisations than we'd been able to the first time around. So we had the major building blocks. So yes, as you say, it's not a different production, but I think we got further in the process. For us, in lots of ways, it's been also been an experiment in a way of working, and we were able to take that much further in the second version.
Well, thank you very much, Zoe. Great.